Welcome into the David L. Gray Show, off code and unscripted on St. Dominic's Media. It is about 11:30 here in Germany, and we are streaming live on Facebook, YouTube, X.com. We have the audio version, however you'd like to get your audio podcast. If you're listening on iTunes, please leave a five-star review. We will appreciate it, helping the algorithm. But however, wherever, whenever you're listening, just glad to have you here for this awesome show. We're going to be speaking today, have a conversation with one of my favorite people in the world. That's Ellen Finnegan. She is an awesome, hilarious person. She's also an important Catholic educator. To find out more about her, just hop over to text2teach.com. That is text, like a text message, text. teach2thetext.com. teach2thetext.com. That's where you can find out more about her. Before we get into the show, though, man, it's a lot going on at St. Dominic's Media. Just want to let you guys know, make sure you check out Kyle Coppy. He had his first podcast yesterday. Check that out. And tomorrow we will have the team here doing a The Final Word podcast. Bobby will be here. Kyle will be here. We're going to be talking about everything that's going on, including what Pope Francis kind of said today. We heard he's talking about seminaries being full of Skittles. So we got to talk about that. And that's going to be an interesting show tomorrow. So make sure you tune in that. And make sure you hop over to stdominicsmedia.com. Become one of our members. We definitely appreciate it. More and more you are becoming free members, exclusive members, and Hounds of Heaven lifetime members. We definitely appreciate your support. It helps us expand what we're doing. Speaking of that, Ellen Finnegan, once you meet her, I think you'll understand why. She's someone who Bobby, Kyle, and I like very much. We've been trying to get her to join our team. But one question sort of remains, is lingering out there. Like, is she someone who you like to see the Ellen Finnegan Show on St. Dominic's Media? If you like her, leave a comment in the box below or email her. Again, she's at teach2thetext.com. Let's get into the show. Hey, before I guess I should maybe segue in this way. And let me tell you when I kind of like first fell in love with Ellen Finnegan. It was when I had to watch this video, and I'm going to watch it with you. Check this out.
Hi, everybody. I'm just sitting here outside the Catholic Church. It's 2020, and I just wanted to remind everybody there's no mass today. Don't come to church. It's closed because we don't want people to get the virus. Okay, thank you. Hi, everybody. It's 2021, and I'm sitting here outside the Catholic Church, and I just wanted to remind everybody that today in the church parking lot, we have the vaccine bus. So thanks to Operation Warp Speed, we now have a vaccine that is safe and effective. So it's right here in the church parking lot. You can come on up and get your vaccine. I know some people are concerned about the unknown risks of getting the vaccine, but you shouldn't worry about that because the most important thing is just not to spread it to other people. There's a lot of old people that might die and you don't want to spread it. So you should really think about Jesus and putting others before yourself and laying down your life for your friends. Okay, so even if there are unknown risks, you should definitely get the vaccine. Come to church. It's right here in the parking lot. Hi all, it's 2022, and I just wanted to let you know that once again, outside the church parking lot, we have the vaccine bus. So even if you got your vaccine in 2021 and you keep getting COVID, and you keep passing it to others, that's just a sign that you need your booster. So get your butt up here to church today. It's right here in the church parking lot, and get your booster. Rest assured that even if you keep getting COVID-19 and you keep getting sick, just know that if you hadn't gotten the vaccine, it would be much worse, okay? So it really does make it lessens the effects. And also, it's been approved for pregnant women and children as well. So bring the kids. Hey everybody, it's 2023. I'm here in the Catholic Church parking lot, and once again, we've got the vaccine bus here. I just wanted to let you guys know that, especially if you're a pregnant woman, today after Mass, you can come out to the vaccine bus, and there's actually abortionists on the vaccine bus, and you can just get your abortion, and then your baby can be donated to science to make vaccines out of the tissues. We all know that the most important thing is to keep people from getting sick, and the only way to make these vaccines is with aborted babies. So this year in the vaccine bus, you can just abort your baby and donate the baby's tissues to science. And that's the way that you make the ultimate sacrifice for others, which is definitely what Jesus would have done. And if you don't want to get an abortion today, you can just and you want to choose to have your child, that's your choice. But we recommend that you just go ahead and sign up your kid for the draft. You can also do that in the bus so that you can eventually make the ultimate sacrifice by sacrificing your child. All right, thank you. Hi everybody, it's 2024. Here I am outside the Catholic Church parking lot, and once again we have the vaccine bus here, and I just wanted to let everybody know that after Mass today, you are welcome to stop by the vaccine bus, and there are suicide pods in there, and you can just go ahead and kill yourself, because if you keep passing COVID-19 to other people, that might be the only option at this point. As long as you're alive, you're just going to keep passing around viruses. So just go ahead and kill yourself after Mass today. It'll be your way of making the ultimate sacrifice. We can stop COVID-19 and prevent global warming together. So vaccine bus right there in the parking lot after Mass. See you there.
So this is why I think Ellen is hilarious. I mean, she's really dark. I mean, some of her stuff, you'll understand why there's content over her Rumble channel that you can't find over at her YouTube channel for Catholics Against Militarism. So, and that's exactly why. some really dark stuff over there, but it's hilarious. That's our guest today. Hey, this is David L. Gray, Off Code and Unscripted on St. Dominic's Media. Let's get into the show. Ellen Finney, and welcome to the David L. Gray Show. How you doing?
I'm good, David. How are you?
Doing well. Good. Were you surprised that that's my favorite video?
Yeah, it's quite a way to introduce me to your audience. Of all the things that I put out there, you went to the most extreme thing that I've ever done. But you know, it's out there, so it's fair game. Yeah.
Actually, I don't think it's like the most extreme. Like the one I struggle with the most was the one where you're talking about abusive relationships. That's over on Rumble. Oh, and at first I thought it was like real. And then I had to go down into like satire. But it was still, even after I read, I was like, oh my gosh, that was something.
But it's quite a parallel too. That one for your audience was about, you know, during COVID, during 2020, I started to make connections with, you know, if Uncle Sam, if the government, the state was my boyfriend, then I'm definitely in an abusive relationship, because the way they were treating us and what they were doing with all of the gaslighting and all of the social programming and all the psyops, I mean, it was very abusive. You know, you're not really supposed to lock people in their houses, prevent them from going to the doctor, prevent them from seeing loved ones, isolate them. I mean, everything that was happening to us in 2020 right. was very, very terrible. And it wasn't because they were trying to keep us safe. And that's why I wanted to make those videos, because that's not what it was about. You know, I think in some ways those videos were my way of reacting to an extreme situation that was really unprecedented on a historical global level. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in a lot of ways, the satire, you know, I felt when I was making a lot of those comedy videos, I felt very much like the sad clown. Like it was definitely coming from a place of, you know, real struggle with what was going on. And I think the other reason I made those videos is because there came a point when logic was not working, reason was not working, and you could not speak to anyone or get through to anyone. And you couldn't really speak about the situation without getting censored. And so when there is that censorship and suppression of thought and exchange of ideas and talking honestly about what was going on, you almost have to go to satire in order to make a point. And I teach Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal in my creative writing classes a lot. I don't know if you've ever read that before.
No.
He was writing about how to solve the problem of poverty in England. And he said, well, we've got too many people and everybody's hungry. So why don't we just eat the babies? And this is a classic, classic piece of satire. So this is what satire is. I mean, it's meant to really be provocative and to make a point when, especially in a social situation, when making a point through reason and logic isn't working anymore for various sociological reasons. So I just to defend, you know, anyone who might be very offended by that clip that you showed, I understand why, but it was satire and satire is supposed to serve a purpose. So
yeah, but even still, the YouTube algorithm did not pick up satire, right? Those videos were nuked, or you were suspended for 2 weeks. Is that what's going on? Did they do that to you over there?
You couldn't talk about the vaccine at all. You couldn't question it. You couldn't even wonder aloud whether it was safe. We were told it was safe. We were told it was effective. It's okay now, 4 years later, to talk about the reality of whether it was safe or effective, but you could not do that at the time. So anything that was talking about the vaccine on my channel was getting strikes. Although it's weird because there were other comedians and people out there who were talking about it who didn't get that kind of censorship. So I don't know. Sometimes I think their rules are kind of arbitrary. Yeah, but I have a lot of great content on the Catholics Against Militarism channel, and I didn't want all of it to go away because I was putting up satire. So
yeah. We're going to get into some of that because I really like some of the conversations you were having over there. But first, I want to get into, and we're going to talk about your homeschooling as well. That's something I've talked a lot about on this channel over the years, the importance of it. But first, I just like to kind of get into, because when we spoke before a couple weeks ago, I really thought it was interesting. We had this conversation about felt banners.
About what?
Felt banners in the church.
Yeah.
And I was really, you know, this is something people always get, you know, one of the things I noticed when I became a Catholic, that one of the major critiques of you get from some traditional Catholics in regards to what they would call Novus Ordo parishes, especially some of the more liberal kind, they would say, is the felt banners. I mean, it just always kept coming up. And as a convert, I'm like, what's wrong with felt, right? But I sort of get it. There's definitely an idea of reality that we should recover the sense of the sacred, that the sacred is important. Mm-hmm. And when we think of sacred and sacred vessels and things that are sacred in the church, we kind of turn to gold and silver, these things that have mystique and order. Felt doesn't fit into that conversation, right? But I want to get into just your experience as being just as a cradle Catholic. That was your experience growing up in just an average sort of typical Novus Ordo community, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I think I told you the joke that, when I first started my podcast, Catholics Against Militarism on YouTube, I did a very popular interview, with E. Michael Jones at the time. It was like my third episode. And somebody commented, this was only in 2019. Somebody commented and said, she is so Novus Ordo. And I was like, oh, thank you. Like, oh, I wonder what that means. And I like had to Google it. Like, this is how out of touch I was. And it's amazing how much has changed in 4 years.
And you think that person, they meant it in like a pejoratory sense?
Totally. Yeah. But at the time I thought it was like, oh, this must be a compliment. And then I realized, oh, they're definitely making fun of me. So that's how Novus Ordo I was. I didn't even know those words or that was a thing. I have since become, you know, as a lot of what's happened since 2020, a lot of those of us who were, I don't know, I now listen to a lot more traditional rad trad Catholic podcasts, you know. Yeah. I And I've even attended the Latin Mass a couple of times. And so I'm kind of getting hip to all of that stuff. But yeah, that's how Novus Ordo I was.
Yeah. So what was your experience growing up? Were you on fire for the faith? Did you go to Life Team? Were you like, how active were you as a kid?
Oh my gosh. I should have sent you my favorite meme that I've come across lately, David. It showed a barge, and it had like this massive barge had like crashed onto the beach. And it was like, you know, how are you going to get this massive barge off the beach? And there was this tiny little crane that was scooping up sand, and it looked like a little toy next to the barge. And the barge said, you know, 15 years worth of secular social programming. And then over the crane, it said, youth group pizza party.
Right.
So, I grew up in the Catholic Church. I went to a very wonderful little elementary school in Omaha, Nebraska called St. Joan of Arc. Okay. Which just now is actually closing, and it saddens me greatly because it was just, we had a nun, Sister Marion, who ran the school, and it was just a wonderful, beautiful little parochial school. And I went there till sixth grade, and, you know, we had the felt banners for sure, and I loved them. but it was a cute little school, and I left in sixth grade. I don't know what it would have been like if I had stayed there. Or if I had gone to Catholic school in Omaha, but I felt like it gave me a really solid basis, not in the intellectual, aspects of the faith, but just, you know, maybe it was just grace, you know, from my baptism, but I was Catholic and that always stayed with me. But my family moved overseas and we went to international schools for a while. And then I was in Georgia during high school and I went to public school. And I did the whole like youth group pizza party thing, which did absolutely nothing to help me learn anything about my faith. All that I remember about my confirmation is what dress I wore. I had to ask my mother when I was like in my early 30s, who was my confirmation saint? I don't even remember. So it was kind of just like a going through the motions kind of thing. And I had no formation at all. And so when I went to college, I went to Boston College. And you know, it was like sort of Catholic. Like I went to mass on Sundays with my roommates, but that was pretty much it. And I think we did we went to Appalachia one spring break and like did Houses for Humanity or something, Habitat for Humanity. But anyway, that was our service, right? So it was very I left college still feeling like, I didn't know this at the time, but I had no formation. So you go into your 20s and, you know, if all you have is a sixth grade Catholic education, you basically have the religion of a child and a child's understanding of your own religion. And then you begin to think that it's a religion for children, that it, you know what I mean? I mean, it's just, you don't understand really. So I kind of moved to New York and I was lived a very kind of secular lifestyle. Yeah. But, you know, God is the hound of heaven and he will not let you go. I think back to St. Joan of Arc in my grade school growing up as a Catholic in this Novus Ordo felt banner parish. And it must have done something for me because I never could quite shake it. And it was always, you know, it did something and it was always there. And, you know, in my mid 20s, I finally had to wrestle with like, I actually dated somebody who I told him I was a Catholic, and he's like, no, you're not. And I'm like, yes, I am. And so he started challenging me on my faith and I couldn't answer any of his questions.
I mean, what was he?
Huh?
Was he a Catholic?
He was a total atheist, like not Catholic at all, completely rejected it. And I realized that I had no answers to any of his questions and I was totally full of shit. Sorry. Sorry to curse on your podcast, but it was true. I was like, I'm full of it. I better like figure this out. Like, do I actually believe this or do I not? And at that time I just launched into this like completely obsessive intellectual pursuit of the truth and basically formed myself and learned everything that I hadn't learned. And God was forming me, but it was very much a conscious effort to try to figure it out. And then once I was intellectually sold on it, then you know what comes next, right? You have to actually start living it. And that's the really hard part. But but at least you can, you know enough to make that decision. So yeah, it was definitely like a long process for me. I'm still in the process of converting. I don't think we really do that once and for all. It's kind of a lifelong process, but that's kind of, is that, I'm sorry, I'm talking a lot.
No, you're good. That's some, that's some good stuff. I mean, that's, I like the way you ended it, but you know, conversion is an ongoing thing. I think Pope Benedict XVI was, you know, he's famous definitely for saying that, that we're always becoming Catholic.
Yeah.
But how was it that the Protestants didn't get a hold of you and save you and tell you that you worship Mary and all of this stuff? How did you avoid that whole thing?
I guess it was those youth group pizza parties. I do remember, I just have one memory from in Georgia in high school. My first day of school, I showed up in geometry class my freshman year, and I looked, the kid next to me had a Bible on his desk, and I was like, oh, I'm sorry, I think I'm in the wrong place. And he goes, well, you're in geometry. And I'm like, oh, like, I don't understand why you have a Bible in this class. But there really wasn't too much of that in, you know, when I was growing up. I know there were like religious people in my high school, but nobody really tried to like save me or evangelize to me. I don't know. I just,
But why Catholic though? Because it seemed like you even though you were born and raised into the faith, it seems like at some point in time in your 20s, you had a choice that you could have just walked away if you were not convinced about, you know, what you received from your parents. What was it that convinced you about Catholicism that made you want to say, okay, this is the one true faith?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I guess I just, you know, when I would go, I actually went to church a couple of times with a friend who wasn't Catholic in high school. She invited me to her youth group pizza party. And I don't know, I just never really, it never struck me as, it struck me, this is going to sound offensive to Protestants, but it kind of struck me as like theater. Like there was always somebody up there talking and giving a sermon, but it, all the emphasis was on this particular person and them having this captive audience and talking to them about their ideas of the Bible or something. And they're just, that never resonated with me. This seemed like there was something really missing. I was like, well, who is this guy anyway? And like, why should I listen to him? And, you know, in Catholicism, like you don't even have to have a homily for an actual, you know, mass to take place. It's kind of optional. It's not really about the priest and his ideas that he had that week. It's about, so I don't know. I think there's just something in the mass and in the Eucharist and my first communion, my, you know, confession, like I always knew that they didn't do that. And it seemed like there was a lot that was missing. So I think for me, it was like, it was Catholicism. It was like when Flannery O'Connor said, like, if it's not true, then to hell with the whole thing. Like if the Eucharist isn't real, then to hell with the whole thing. Like why even bother? You know? Yeah. So that, I think that was my Catholic mindset.
And speaking of that, Catholic Gistero, my friend John here, he asked, Ellen, when did you discover the truth about the Holy Eucharist?
Oh, my first communion in second grade. Yeah.
And you never doubted that?
No, never, never, never doubted that. It was just, never doubted it.
Yeah. I think that's really, really cool how people, I mean, this obviously is the grace of the Holy Spirit. I mean, you're baptized, you're confirmed as a youth.
Yeah.
And, you know, that stays with you and it never left you. And that's a definite grace from God. But your parents, though, what role did you feel? Sometimes I wonder about cradle Catholics, particular ones who leave and, you know, go into other faith traditions. Like, I wonder how they feel about their parents that And I say this about myself, having, you know, four daughters and, you know, trying to raise them in the faith and trying to do my best. If your parents kind of neglect your formation, is there like a feeling that you were robbed by them, or is there like any feelings towards parents in that way?
No, it's hard for me to talk about my parents. I don't want to start crying because they're the best. But no, my parents have been married for 50 years and they just celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary in January. And, you know, they didn't have that formation. They grew up in like the 60s and 70s and their school, they left. My father went to a cathedral in Omaha, St. Cecilia's, and him, he had seven brothers and sisters, and they just left. And we're all pretty, his side of the family, my aunts and uncles have all really embraced the faith over the years, most of them. And they laugh about how poor their formation was as well. I mean, so you can't give what you don't have, but, you know, it wasn't, you know, we didn't sit down and do the rosary every night or anything, but they taught me through their example of what a Christian, they taught through their example. And that is way, I mean, that's the most powerful thing. That was their witness, and whether, and it just was second nature to them. It wasn't informed by all this like study of scripture or reading of St. Benedict's blah, 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 or St. Thomas Aquinas. They just did it. They just lived it. They just exhibited that for us. So I don't really have any complaints about them.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. And Catholic Hysteria says, he says, I knew it. I guess to your response, that is why she didn't go to Protestantism, I guess, because she actually believed in Holy Eucharist. He says that happened to me. And Margaret says, Ellen, you seem genuine, kind, and well-spoken. Thank you for speaking today.
Thanks, Margaret. Nice. That's so kind of you to say. I was really worried after we started with that vaccine bus video. First impressions matter, right?
Yeah, they do. I thought it was interesting too that you and I guess maybe had some overlap, or maybe when I was leaving Colby Academy, you were coming into Colby. And I wanted to talk about that for a moment.
Yeah, I actually wanted to follow up with my friends at Colby and say, when did David work there? Because I was definitely there the first year of the online school. Yeah. And so, yeah, we must have crossed paths.
You know, in hindsight, I do remember, I think I remember your name or your picture or something like that, but it's, you know, it's a vague memory. But
yeah,
Catholic education, that's something, education in general, it's just something I've just always been around, something I'm interested in, something I do now, right? But what's your thoughts on, I guess we could start there, Colby Academy. I mean, what did you think about your time there? And for those who don't know, Colby Academy, you know, they have a regular school in Napa, but they also have an online sort of feature where some parents would outsource parts of their education, you know, they're homeschooling their children, or maybe their children are going to regular secular Catholic schools and they're somehow they're supplementing some aspects or all aspects of their child's education to Colby. Colby has online live classes, they provide materials and everything like that. So I'm still a big supporter of what they do and who they are and what they believe in. But how did you find that as, is that something you would still recommend, that type of homeschooling outsourcing for parents?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And I should give a shout out to my student, Nathaniel, because he gave me these buttons and I don't know if you can see them. But I put them on at the last minute. They say, Nietzsche is dead. God is not dead. So Nathaniel, thank you. I loved Colby. Colby, I give Colby credit for partially for my ongoing, you know, formation. And I cannot say enough about what teaching at Colby did for me. Before I taught at Colby, I had a bachelor's degree in English and a master's in creative writing. And I had never read anything written before Shakespeare. And so suddenly I was thrown into this world of classical education, and I taught their curriculum And that was huge for me. I mean, in terms of my, not just my intellectual development, but my spiritual development and being a part of Colby, you know, the colleagues, the people I worked with, the families, my students helped to form me too. And, helped me in my pursuit of truth. And so I can't say enough about it. Colby is a great school, great education. I came into homeschooling. I graduated in 2008 with my master's in creative writing. Before that, I had worked sort of in the corporate world, like at a few startup companies. And I didn't really know if I wanted to go back to that. And I went up to New York for an interview with an old employer of mine. He's like, come on back, come on back. Like, you've done your writing thing. Like, come back to the real world now. And I was like, oh, I don't know if this is right. And so I was going to this, I decided I was going to try to do writing coaching, like teach writing on my own. So I was going to this homeschool conference, and I decided to say, my aunt told me to say a novena to St. Joseph, patron saint of work. So the conference ended up on the ninth day of my novena, and I had finished this novena of St. Joseph, and I went to this conference, and like nobody was coming to my table, and like I felt so bad. It was like, wah, 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 like maybe I'm gonna maybe I'm gonna have to go back to the corporate world. But at the end of the conference, these women came up to me, and they were like, oh, we're at this table over here, and we just saw your table. And they start talking to me, and they're like, we're starting a school. We're starting a hybrid school, and we're starting in ninth grade. Do you want to come teach for us? And I was like, I don't think I can. Like, I don't have a degree in education or anything. Yeah. And they were like, these are homeschooling parents. They don't care. Like, they don't care about that. They teach their own kids without degrees. And I was like, okay. So I got thrown into teaching at this hybrid school called St. John Bosco in Atlanta.
Okay.
Which started with just a group of women who were gathering around their kitchen table, and they were like, okay, you teach science, you teach math, you teach English or whatever. And they started growing, and then they rented out a floor of a local school that was declining in their enrollment. And so they started a school on one floor, and that's when I taught there, and I taught their first ninth grade class, and I was teaching the Colby curriculum at the time. So, and by the way, oh, this is a long story, but I had been praying because I was like, I really want to teach writing in English, but I don't want to work full time. I just want to do it part time. And I'd really like to be in a classroom, but I'd also like to teach homeschoolers. And this was my prayer. I had this list of things I was praying for, and these things don't exist. Like, you don't get to teach part time. You don't get to teach in a real school, but also teach homeschoolers. But this was my prayer. And this ended up being exactly what I found at St. John Bosco. And I never even knew that hybrid schools existed. Anyway, that's the way that, you know, thank you, St. Joseph. But anyway, I taught there, and then these women, they're just incredible. They ended up raising enough money to buy land outside of Atlanta and build their own school. So they are, now they have like this huge school in Atlanta. They're just incredible, but they were so inspiring to me. And, you know, this is what subsidiarity is, right? And I love working with parents that, you know, take primary responsibility for their children's education. And I love working with homeschooling families. I really love it. So I've been doing that since, that was in 2011. And then the next year I ended up, Colby hired me because I had been teaching their curriculum anyway. And they heard about me through the grapevine. And then I was there for 9 years. Yeah. So it was a great experience.
Wow. And now you are at teachtothetext.com. What are you doing there?
Teach to the Text. I'm really bad at updating my website. So if you're interested, I would go to courses.teachtothetext.com. And it's T-E-X-T, not T-E-S-T. Get it? So I started that last year. It's been up for about 14 months now. And my time at Colby had run its course, and I was feeling a little bit burned out with the amount. I taught 8 classes, plus, you know, ran the newsletter club, plus worked on curriculum projects, plus, you know, I did a lot there. And so I think it had run its course. I miss it. I still miss it. And I still love Colby, but I needed to kind of stretch my legs, maybe try teaching in a different way. And I also was really eager after all those years to create some of my own courses that I knew I would never be able to teach there and to kind of go out on my own and do my own thing. So now I'm teaching, I teach mostly high school composition, writing, literature, and also hire some people from time to time to come teach classes. Hugh Owen from the Colby Center for the Study of Creation, which is different than Colby Academy, is teaching a class on 6-day creation starting in June. And so, yeah, it's been fun to just kind of, you know, stretch my legs a little bit and and do something different.
Yeah, I'm excited for you. Definitely excited for you. Happy for you as well to have the opportunity to do what obviously God has gifted you to do. So that's courses.teachtothetext.com. Yes. And I'll post a link in the description.
Thanks, David.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I'm a big fan of yours. Stop. So one thing I want to talk about though, and I want to transition like this. I didn't tell Ellen this, but this is how I want to transition to another part of our conversation.
Oh, so, surprise. I was telling you, I've never done a live stream before. Yeah. So I'm like, what's he gonna do?
Oh, no. It things happen. But so this is another video. I'm just gonna play a part of it to the piece that I wanna, you know, segue into. Here we go.
Marina, what do you think about all this crazy UFO stuff that's going on? Oh my gosh, I'm so excited. They're coming soon. I can't wait. I think it's amazing. Yeah, I'm so excited. But they're not UFOs. They're objects. Well, I mean, they are unidentified, but they're not like flying around like they do in movies. I think they're just like floating. Well, right, but even then it would still be. Well, I don't know what's going on with them. I just know it's very exciting, and I think it's very important to keep an open mind and just consider all the possibilities about what this could mean.
Exactly. I am right there with your satire character, Sabrina.
Oh.
And this is how, and you know, the people who watch my channel, you know, my followers, they've been knowing this about me for years. When it comes to UFOs, when it comes to mer people, I don't play around. Don't play with me. This is my wheelhouse. So I want to segue like this into the conversation on Just War. I know this is a silly segue, but here's the thing. I do believe in mer people, right? And possibly that they're the UFOs that we see, because and this had been proven by the Congress, you know, when they had that report, I think it was 2022, 2020, it was in July. They had all these incidents over 140 or something like that about UFO encounters that they cannot explain. Over 98% of them had occurred over water. Okay. So this is how I'm like, oh man, these must be the mer people, right? So there's modern evidence.
When you are talking about mer people, do you mean like mermaids and mermen?
Don't play with me, Ellen. Yes.
Is that mermaids? Because like, they're like all Aquaman. Over water. Oh, wait, now your theory is coming together. Now I'm intrigued. Tell me more. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm, yeah. So this is where, you know, these UFOs come from. There's plenty of evidence for that. You know, there's the encounters that happen in Russia. There's the encounters that happen, you know, around the North Pole. This is just, you know, just unrefutable evidence that there is some sort of highly intelligent life underwater. Okay. Now, but I'll take this back to the biblical text, right? Jesus, when he says there's a reason why Jesus is always preaching around water. Why? Because when he says that he has sheep in other places, this is who he may be referring to. Jesus. And it's funny, you know, the apostles find Jesus just walking on the water. Why was he walking on water? Who is he talking to? What was he doing out there? All right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. The storms that come. Storms. Mm-hmm. See, before Pontius Pilate tried to kill Jesus, right? People don't notice about mer people. There's factions. There's divisions, right? There isn't just one mer people. There's different kingdoms underwater.
I didn't know that.
Yes, don't play with me. Yes. And so one of these factions just tried to take Jesus out. This is why this storm comes. And Jesus is not even thinking about it. He's sleeping in the boat. He's, I'm not worried about these mer people, right?
Yeah.
But my question, having said all that, I could do a whole show about, you know, mer people.
Please do.
All this. Yeah. I'll lay all my evidence out there one
Can
day.
Can I come but, you know, on as Sabrina and talk about the mer people with you? Because, yeah.
I would love that.
That would be fun.
But my question is this. If more people, if they ever like exit from these like spaceships and everything like that, they make themselves known to the public, kind of like they what they did in a, you know, the last Wakanda movie, Marvel. If they were to make themselves known in one of the factions, which seems to be pretty violent, seem to be very hostile towards, you know, governments, maybe the United States. Do you think that the just war theory would apply to mer people and we can take them out? What do you think? Do you see the segue now?
I do. And I think that would be the one time when you could use violence is to defeat the mer people. Absolutely. Yes. But I would say werewolves, aliens, vampires, definitely no. But yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to the mer people, I think you make such a good, solid, logical case that I would give that my stamp of approval. Yeah.
Now, I first bumped into you when I had my my most recent interview with E. Michael Jones. You know, it was on YouTube, and you know how the algorithm works. Other interviews with E. Michael Jones had popped up, and this time yours had popped up with him. And so I was a little bit intrigued. So I go to your channel, and that's when I find out more about you. And your YouTube channel is called Catholics Against Militarism. And then I went to your website. You know, I just really studied what this whole thing was about, and simply because I was interested in the subject. I had written some pieces about why I don't think the just war theory is as applicable today, simply because, you know, I find war, the point in time that the just war theories were being developed, you know, you did have Visigoths, Vandals, Huns, you know, invading Northern Africa, you know, places in Europe. And people were trying to understand, how do we live as Christians yet defend ourselves? And so these things started to develop. But nowadays, you know, we know that war is a corporate boardroom type of thing. It's a account on a ledger. It's being waged by, you know, Blackstreet, Vanguard, these type of corporations. You know, it seems to me to be just a redistribution of wealth. There's the destruction side, and then there's the rebuilding side. There's a lot of money to be made, and I see that people are interested in it. It seems like that people who are the poor people are the ones that are mainly harmed by this redistribution of wealth to keep these corporations' coffers very fat. Mm-hmm. But I noticed in some of your videos, in some of your comments, and some of the comments of the people who you were just interviewing. And Ellen is a wonderful interviewer. She just likes her people she interviews just talk. She asks a question and they just go. I think that's the interesting way to interview. And I think it seems like you're a student sometimes, and you're just like, oh, mm-hmm. And I see you taking notes. It's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. But your perspective on the just war theory is a little bit. I guess we both would be opposed to it. You know, I guess war in general, albeit for different reasons. What are your reasons?
Opposed to the just war theory, you mean?
Or just, you know, war in general. In general, but the idea that there's a list of things we can check off to justify it.
Well, you know, I think I started down this path in 2010. I went to live at a place called Agape Community. Long story there, but I met Father McCarthy, Father Charles Emmanuel Charles McCarthy there.
total kind of stroke of luck. I was there for 9 months and he just happened to be there. When Jim Douglas came into town to do an author talk at Agape Community. And so Jim Douglas wrote JFK and the Unspeakable, which is kind of widely known as one of the best, most well-researched books. He's also a Catholic worker. Anyway, I met these people at this place and they all sort of believed in this thing called gospel nonviolence, which I had never even heard of before. And I was like, okay, whatever. Like that sounds kind of unrealistic, you know? I left 9 months later. But when I was there, when Father McCarthy and Jim Douglas were there, one of Father McCarthy's friends came up to me and he was like, have you heard about the miracle of Charlie's daughter? And I kind of rolled my eyes. I was like, oh yeah, miracle, you know, like what she got over a cold or something. You know, I was very cynical. And he's like, well, no, like his daughter, you know, here's this DVD about some ABC news special about this miraculous cure. And I was like, okay, thanks. When I left this place, I moved to Atlanta and I took some of these materials with me. And it wasn't until later that I started listening to them. And I found out that actually Father McCarthy's daughter did experience an actual miracle that was acknowledged by the Catholic Church, and she was miraculously cured after taking an overdose of Tylenol when she was like 2 years old. And I read Father McCarthy's like story behind this miracle. And I was like, wait a minute. Whoa, this is like a real thing. And I have to say that was kind of the hook. But this was one of two miracles that made Edith Stein a saint, Saint Teresa Benedicta of the Cross. And I started getting really interested. So then I was like, maybe I should listen to what this guy has to say. So I started looking into Father McCarthy's materials, listening to his materials, and learning about Christian nonviolence. And so I'm sorry. No, this is like a long-winded answer to your question. But I realized that there's two, what they call it, the USCC bishops in A Harvest of Justice is sown in peace. They said an essential component of a spirituality for peacemaking is an ethic for dealing with conflict in a sinful world. The Christian tradition possesses two ways to address conflict: nonviolence and just war. So, you know, there are two streams of tradition in our church. And they write, they both share the common goal to diminish violence in this world. And they said, the Christian has no choice but to defend peace. We don't have an option. We have to defend peace. It's an inalienable obligation. It is the how of defending peace that offers moral options. So we have to defend peace. The question is, how are we going to do that? And in answering this how, we have options, they say, moral options. We take up the dual tradition, recognizing on the one hand the success of nonviolent methods in recent history, and on the other hand, throughout history there has been a shifting relationship between the two streams of the tradition, which always remain in tension. And so when I started looking into this, I realized that most people know absolutely nothing about the tradition of nonviolence in the church. And there's absolutely no tension between the two because of that. There's no tension. It's like most 99% of Catholics are like, just war theory, end of story. And so I started looking into the just war theory. What is this? When did it come about? What is it standing in the church? And I realized that it's basically the product of human philosophy and human reasoning. You know, it was brought about, I think Cicero wrote the first just war theory. Don't quote me on that. And Ambrose and Augustine kind of developed it. And then St. Thomas Aquinas. But when you start to look into it, it's really not on such sturdy, there's a shaky foundation there, and it's not this, people treat it like it's dogma or something. And it's not, right. You know, there's a difference between dogma and like tradition with a capital T and then tradition with a lowercase t. And it's definitely tradition with a lowercase t. So a lot of my exploring all this has been sort of putting the just war theory in the proper context of the faith. And I think when you do that, you kind of come to see that it's, in the words of John L. McKenzie, who was one of the most preeminent theologians of the 20th century, he said it's a piece of moral, he said it's a piece of phony, hold on, I wrote down the quote. It's a piece of phony morality. A piece of phony morality. And I get criticized a lot on my channel for those kinds of critiques of just war theory. But I think one thing that's important to keep in mind is that in the Catholic Church, and I'm sharing this with your audience because nobody knows this. Like I was never taught this. Nobody knows this. There are degrees of acceptance and certainty of faith in the Catholic Church. So not everything that you read in the catechism is on the same level in terms of whether we have to accept it or agree with it. There are 8 different levels, and only the top 2 are dogma that we have to believe as Catholics. And the rest of the church teachings kind of fall somewhere in these different levels. Just war theory, I mean, I don't know. I don't think they like stamp different doctrines with like an official, this is the level of certainty, but it probably falls somewhere on the 7th or 8th level of certainty called well-founded teaching or tolerated opinion. Well-founded teaching is teaching that is well-reasoned but does not rise to being called probable. And tolerated opinion is opinion that is tolerated but discouraged within the church. And I think just war theory falls under one of those two. So no Catholic by any means is obligated to believe in it, let alone conduct their life according to its very abstract, philosophical, somewhat unrealistic, teachings or whatever. So that's kind of, does that make sense? Like how I feel about the just war theory?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think you articulated it very well. I got a couple of follow-up questions, but very well. You know, St. Dominic's Media, you know, our motto is pursuing peace through truth, right? Because we believe that, the truth leads to peace because truth is Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ is the King of Peace, right? So, truth sets us free. So, as Dominicans, we pursue truth. Right. So truth is, first principle. So I think that obviously leads to peace. But also heard you, even the application of the just war theory. And I don't have my catechism out, but, it delineates certain conditions that must be met. Mm-hmm. And is your thought that even if we were to apply the just war theory, that there's still no situations where we could even go to war? Is that your idea?
Yeah, I think this is kind of where most of the church is headed. I think it was Pope Benedict. I wanted to look up this quote, but I couldn't find it before the podcast. I think it was Pope Benedict XV who said we should be asking ourselves the question of whether it is even possible to admit the existence of a just war. That's a pope saying that. That's not my idea. He's saying we need to be asking the question, can there be a just war, especially at this point in history? And that when he uses the word should, like in my mind, that's a moral imperative that you have to ask that question. Not if this or that or this or that or this or that war is just, but whether it can even exist. And different Catholics might answer that in different ways. But I think the first best step for the church would be to actually teach the just war theory. I have talked to 3 different priests who have been through seminary, and I always ask them, did you study the just war theory? All 3 of them have said, we did for one afternoon. And they studied it in a philosophy course. They studied it in philosophy. So even our priests aren't really learning much about it. Certainly our Catholic school children don't learn anything about it. And so it's not, to me, that's not taking it very seriously. When you go into the military and you are a Catholic in the military, the Catholic chaplains are actually not allowed to proactively teach you the just war theory of the Catholic Church. They're not allowed to do it. They have to stay mum. The only time they can bring it up is if a soldier comes to them with a crisis of conscience, and then they can be, well, this is what the church teaches, blah, blah, blah. So I think there's a lot of problems there. You know, we had, I think, two or three popes come out and speak out against the invasion of Iraq in 2003, but 25% of the military that carried out that invasion was Catholic. So there's a problem there.
Yeah. Humans murdering humans is just not part of the natural order of things, right? We see that the first instance of a human murdering a human or killing a human, you know, happens after the fall, you know, mm-hmm. Cain and Abel. So it's just not part of the natural order of how we were created, who we were created to be is humans. And so it seems to me that anytime that we see humans murdering humans, whether it's abortion, whether it's at the point in time, the death penalty, whether it's war, it seems to me that what we have to do first is admit that there's a failure has taken place, a failure to love, a failure to be who we're called to be, a failure to treat each one another how we ought. The human condition, of course, you know, precludes that, you know, the circumstances, where place that we're raised, you know, the environment, sin, occasions of sin, falling into sin, all these things play a role in that failure, right? But war in particular, you know, in the case of the conversation that we're having now, we're talking about massive failures, like institutional failures. The point in time when one nation rises up against another, to, so to speak, put down or see someone being a threat, you know, weapons of mass destruction. You know, when they see these things, it's, oh, they must be put down. You know, this is failure on a massive institutional nationwide levels. So how do we, it's one thing to say that, because I heard you speak about these two streams, you know, just war and the gospel of peace running concurrently in our tradition, right? But when we see these instances of failure, and we have to, the thought is that we have to respond with violence. How do you even return to a point of how can even the gospel of peace even have room to breathe or even to converse or even have a say in this space where as humans are it seems to be our first reaction with governments is we have to choose violence in response to this failure?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that we have to go back to Jesus Christ, and he is our model and he is our God. He's our Lord. And he, you know, this, like you said, this goes back to the first sin that was committed outside of Eden. And we can't think that Jesus came to show us the way, the truth, and the life, and he didn't have anything to say about this. We can't think that he didn't show us the way. He did show us the way, and not only in the way that he lived and in the way that he died, but in what he said. And we have to listen to him. We have to listen to him, and we have to believe that he meant what he said, and that it's not only logical. It might not strike us as logical in the beginning, because let's make it clear, the just war theory owes nothing to anything that Jesus Christ ever said or did. It's human philosophy. It's human reasoning. And Jesus is God, and he knows better than we do how to deal with the reality of human life. He sees the big picture. And I think that ultimately our reliance on violence, I think it was, I can't remember who said this, but they said a reliance on violence is always comes down to a crisis of faith. Like, you know, and so Jesus, it's not like he didn't say anything about violence. He said plenty, but we just don't tend to listen to him. He said, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. Resist not evil. I send you out as sheep among wolves. Turn the other cheek. Those who seek to save their life in this world will lose it. Those who lose their life in this world for my sake will save it. He told Peter to put down his sword, and then he healed the ear of Malchus. I mean, it's everywhere. I think John L. McKenzie, who I quoted earlier, said that if we cannot know that Jesus was nonviolent, then we can know nothing of his person or of his teachings. It is the clearest of teachings. That's what he said. So if we are dismissing this whole aspect of the love of God as shown through the life and words of Jesus Christ, we're blind and we're not going to get it. And we're not going to know what to do in a situation that we think based on, you know, 10 years of watching The Walking Dead, we think, oh, I know what I have to do in this situation. I have to blow their head off, right? And I don't mean to make light of it, but we are all inundated in this culture with the opposite of what Jesus taught on this issue. So we have to go back to Jesus. We have to take him at his word. Do you remember when he told the servants at Cana to fill up the jugs with water?
Yeah.
Like, that would have made no sense. Let's face it. That would have made absolutely no logical sense to anybody. But what did Mary say? She said, do whatever he tells you. Do whatever he tells you. They didn't know why they were doing it this way. They didn't know what it could possibly lead to, but they did it. And that's, so we have to keep that in mind, is that Jesus gets the big picture. He loves us more than anything. He wants the best for us. And we just have to take him at his word. And the only person that I've ever run across in my life who can actually explain gospel nonviolence and make it seem not only logical, but theological, is Father Emmanuel Charles McCarthy. Because it is logical, but it's not logical in a human way, but it's theological. Take the theo away from it, and it's insane, and it seems completely ridiculous. But put the theo on there, theological, and it makes perfect sense. I think we have to trust Jesus. That's what I'm trying to say. We have to trust that he knew what he was talking about, and stop putting our trust in other things. Does that make sense?
But I did notice that some critique of Father McCarthy, right? That some would say that that some of what he may say may fall out of, right, the parameters in which, you know, as theologians, we can stay within. You know, we leave these parameters of the magisterial teaching, you know, we fall into disobedience, right? Mm-hmm. Have you found cases where, you know, he's being critiqued as falling outside of the parameters in which we can speak about these things?
Yes, all the time. But I think it's just important to keep in mind that he's been at this for almost 60 years. And he's not quiet. He's not flying under the radar. He's been saying these things loud and clear as a priest, but he is a priest in good standing with the Catholic Church, in full communion with the Catholic Church under the Pope. He's a Melkite. He's in the Melkite rite, but he's in communion with Rome, and he has never been sanctioned or censured for saying anything that he's been saying for the past 60 years. You know, I'm sure if he was heretical or heterodox or saying things that oppose what you can say as a Catholic, then he would never be able to get away with that. Because everybody, well, he was a little more famous, I guess, back in the day. But yeah, he's perfectly within the realm of what you can believe as a Catholic. I think the hard part is that when people hear, they only ever know just war and that kind of mentality. And when they start to hear and really explore gospel nonviolence, it does create some cognitive dissonance in people. Because you can't, I mean, you can hold two ideas in your mind that are completely opposed. But we all know that when it came down to living it, you know, you have to choose one or the other. So So there has to be room within those moral options for people who would choose, people of goodwill who would choose different options to critique the other one. And so, yeah, for him to criticize the just war theory, I think when it, especially when it's such a low, it's not dogma. It is a very low level of certainty in the church.
It hasn't been revealed by God. It's exactly. Not a dogma, or nor is it an explanation of a dogma. So,
yeah.
It's very low.
Yeah.
Now, I want to get to a couple of questions that we have over here. But first, I wanted to play this video that I thought this is one of your most interesting videos, because you actually read the book of Acts and you thought it was like one of the most boring reads. And it sort of relates to the conversation that we're having now. And so I was a little bit alarmed when I first saw this video. The Acts Apostles boring. I thought you were just doing your cradle Catholic thing. I was a little bit alarmed, right? But I want everyone to, you know, check this out. I thought it was pretty interesting. Let's play it.
Hey, everybody. I'm sitting here at the coffee shop today reading my Bible with my latte. It's very nice. I just have a quick question. I'm reading the Acts of the Apostles for the first time. Where are all the sword fights? Like, seriously, I've always been told that Jesus told his apostles to buy a sword so they could defend themselves. And so far, they're just getting, like, beaten and, like, thrown in jail and stuff. And there's, like, no sword fights. And, I mean, I hate to say it, but it's, like, a little boring. Like, I don't know. I guess I was just preparing myself for, like, a little more action. But there's no action so far. So maybe they, like... Do you know, like, does it get more interesting? Like, do they fight off some bandits on the road later or something? I don't know. Hoping it just, I don't know, pick up the pace a little bit later. Maybe you guys know more about Acts of the Apostles than I do. Let me know in the comments. Any sword fights? Are they still to come or what? Talk to you later.
I thought that was really hilarious because, you know, as a person who loves, you know, dragons and swords and like Middle Earth, Lord of the Rings, you know, Game of Thrones, that type of thing. It's nothing like the Acts of the Apostles is nothing like that, but it seems that it would be, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If Jesus taught a way of self-defense and for justice under certain circumstances, you bet they would have been finding some way to justify defending themselves. I find cheeky ways of making points sometimes just because I think it's kind of funny and fun. But I think a lot of the objections, you know, there's a lot of misunderstanding out there about this, about, you know, what Jesus taught and what a lot of it is just kind of at this point, it's like cliche. Like when I hear somebody say, well, Jesus told his disciples to buy a sword. So obviously he believed in self-defense. I'm like, really? Are we still at that level of understanding when it, like, you know, that objection or that point has been answered well so many times by scripture scholars and people who can explain what he meant by that. He certainly didn't mean go defend yourself with one sword against the Roman Empire. Like, that's definitely not what he meant. It's just kind of interesting to think about that. Why were they allowing themselves to be treated that way instead of fighting? And then I've had other people tell me, well, it's because they were the minority and that's why they couldn't, you know, take up arms against the empire. But now that Christians are in the majority and we've got the guns and the bombs and the nukes, now we can use them. Like, it doesn't really make sense.
Revolution is just always the minority. I mean, it tends to be, and they always have weapons and they tend to find a way, right? Now, let me get to Davis first. Andrew David, he said he spent years of my life practicing violence against others on behalf of the U.S. It led me to despair and confusion. Gospel nonviolence heals my soul from the trauma. What are your thoughts on that, Ellen?
Wow, that's beautiful. Andrew, I'm glad that you found that. I'm curious where he came across gospel nonviolence. Okay. It's too bad we can't talk to them. But they, it was his name, Andrew. I'm glad that you found that and you found healing. Because, you know, we can only, I mean, we only make decisions based on what we know at the time. And I, as someone with two brothers who went into the military, I mean, they're some of the best people that I know. And some of the best people that I know go into the military because they do have actually an idea of self-sacrifice and an idea of service that a lot of people today don't have. So I think sometimes, you know, we can have good motivations and somehow the devil doesn't have anything to work with, right? So he just has to take what's good and twist it around. And anyway, I'm glad you found healing.
One thing I think is definitely twisted around, and as someone who, you know, for quite a while, I've kind of been in this, you know, Department of Defense sphere. Every year, you know, Memorial Day comes around, right? It's that time. And we hear this phrase, you know, the greatest sacrifice. It always rubbed me really wrong. I guess after I became a Catholic and perhaps after I encountered Jesus Christ, does the phrase, someone who has, you know, like you said, brothers in the military, how's that phrase rub you, that dying for in a military conflict is the greatest sacrifice?
A lot of people try to equate the sacrifice of the soldier with the sacrifice of Jesus, because Jesus said, you know, I consider you my friend, and there's no greater love than if one lies down their life for a friend. But it has to be said, it has to be pointed out that the job of the soldier is not to lay down his life. The job of the soldier is to make someone else lay down theirs. And that is different than what Jesus did.
Yeah.
You know what one of my favorite movies is? Have you ever seen Hacksaw Ridge?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely saw that.
So yeah.
I think at some point in the movie, he keeps going back and he's saying he has to get one more, right? Mm-hmm. And he keeps going to get these soldiers who are wounded, and he keeps going back and back. It's definitely an inspiring movie in that regard.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great study. There's also a documentary called The Conscientious Objector about Desmond Doss. And I think it does challenge this idea of, like, you know, what's possible. You know, nothing is impossible with Christ. Nothing is impossible with God. What he did on Hacksaw Ridge in Japan, going into battle without a gun and saving like 75 men in the middle and never getting... There are stories of, like, Japanese men, like, had their target trained on him and their gun jammed and they couldn't shoot him. There's, you know, what he did was impossible by this world. It's impossible, but he survived it and he did it. And so sometimes I think we just fail to appreciate what can be accomplished when we truly try to carry out the will of God as it was revealed by Jesus. You know, we just can't, like, even imagine what would be possible if we would really trust I don't like nonviolence. Father McCarthy always says it's not a noun, it's an adjective to describe the kind of love that Jesus showed to us, which we are called to show to others. You know, just this Sunday in Mass, one of the readings was the Great Commission, right? Like, I go out baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey all that I commanded you. So that's what we're supposed to be doing, is teaching people to obey Jesus and what he commanded, not coming up with philosophical ideas about how to, like, modify what he said or get out of it or do something else. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's definitely, I think that's the harder way. And I think there's struggle there. And I don't think we, in our condition, sometimes we appreciate the struggle, even with teachings of the church. Like you said earlier, sometimes we fall into this sleep of just accepting what we've heard. And when something runs counter to that, it's a struggle. Like, oh, what is this thing? I think a lot of people have been struggling with the change in paragraph 2267 concerning the death penalty. Like, that's, And if the last catechism you read was a catechism of Trent, or the last catechism you read was in question answer format, that type of thing, or the last theologian you read was, you know, Thomas Aquinas, I get the struggle, right? But struggle is good, and we should engage in that battle. But there is also the lingering question I have in the comment box, just about I guess the human failure that I was speaking about earlier, that there's times when we have went to war. So let me put a couple of these up here for you and just get your thoughts about these. Catholicus Theros says, and I'll put two of his up here. He says, in my honest opinion, America has not been in a war that is just since World War II. He says, I think Hitler needed to be aborted when he was a baby. No, he doesn't say that. He says, I think Hitler needed to be stopped. And then he says, was the church wrong to defeat the Muslims? Can you comment on both of those? And he's also talking about self-defense.
Yeah.
Ellen, you're talented enough to wrap all that up. Can you wrap it all up in a comment?
Oh, can I address these major issues in a soundbite? Sure. So it's, yeah, was the church wrong to defeat? I don't know. I mean, what do you mean by the church? It's never necessarily wrong to win.
I guess he would say Lepanto, right? So they're praying the rosary. The Muslims are, that's an example of a peace, right? You know, the Muslims about to take Europe. They start praying the rosary. But the armies are defeated, right? I mean, that was just, right?
Well, and yeah, and Constantine, right, wanted at the Battle of Milvian Bridge or whatever, like he was, he saw a cross in the sky and a message that said, in this sign you will conquer. And then he put it on all his horses and then he won. So does that mean that God was giving his stamp of approval or God was on their side? I mean, I think almost everybody who's ever fought in any war thinks God is on their side. I mean, right? Like there's a Joan Baez song, if you want me to get real hippie about it. But you know, how do we really know? I mean, what we have is Jesus, who came and showed us the way, and the way to participate in the love of God. And you do at some point just have to ask yourself, what would Jesus do? Can you imagine Jesus on that ship bombing people or what? I mean, can you imagine him doing that? I mean, that's always a fail-safe way to try to check the truth of what you believe, you know, in terms of what's moral or immoral. Would Jesus do it? I know that sounds very Protestant of me and like something I would have got from my friends in high school in Atlanta, but that's our model. That's what we're called to imitate. So, if I can't picture Jesus doing it, then I don't want any part of that. And I know there's a lot of wars in history where people can look at both sides and enter into that just war thinking of like, well, who was fighting defensively and who was fighting aggressively and which one was proportional, which one wasn't, and like who was right and who was wrong. And I teach Homer to my homeschool students. And one thing I love about Homer is like, he basically points out throughout the whole thing that the Trojan War was just one big, lie. Like they said, oh, we can go invade Troy and slaughter all their men and kidnap all their women and take all their stuff because Paris ran off with Menelaus's wife. And so when it comes to war, you know, as you were saying earlier, David, like there's always the surface reason of why something needs to happen, but we all know that under that there is human greed and pride and sin that is driving it. And Homer makes it very clear, without even having the light of Christ, that it is hate and terror and fear that is driving those men in that battle. And anyone who's been in war knows that. Anybody who's been there knows that. So do you think that Jesus is that what Jesus wanted us to do? Is that how Jesus wanted us to deal with conflict, and I don't think so. So yeah, maybe it seems overly simplistic to some. If you're interested in exploring this, at courses.teachthetext.com, if you go up to My Offerings, I have created a curriculum on the Hunger Games for teenagers and parents and families to do, that is a reading of the first book in the Hunger Games in simultaneously, like in tandem, listening to Father McCarthy's Behold the Lamb, which teaches gospel nonviolence. I guarantee you, if you are going on a road trip this summer or something, it will make for some great family discussions. And like David was saying, challenging, uncomfortable, you know, wrestling with these ideas. And then there's another one called Behold the Lamb Retreat, where I've written a study guide for Behold the Lamb, which is Father McCarthy's talks on nonviolence. And that's like free. And then if you want the study guide, you can pay like 10 bucks or something. But if you're interested in exploring this, I invite you to walk into the deep waters, get out of the shallows of the just war theory, and really try to understand why Jesus taught us to love our enemies, and why that is actually theological and not just a bunch of utopian idealism. So,
yeah. Okay. David Andrew, this is a long comment. I think I got caught off at the end. He said, I was first introduced by Ellen. I currently work with the VA. Her channel helps a lot of vets. I went on a men's camp out with our priest a few weeks ago. I was just starting to read Father McCarthy. One of the men brought his 11-year-old son while we sat around the fire. Out of the blue, the kid asked, Father, Jesus said not to kill and told Peter to put down a sword. How can Catholics be in the military? Wow. The priest responded personally, I don't think there is a good justification.
Wow. Well, I'm so glad to hear that the channel helps veterans. That's awesome. And yeah, children can often see the contradictions easier than we can, right? And then when we grow up, we find ways of rationalizing things for various reasons. But yeah, I hope that shed some light on the issue. I've really appreciated you taking the time to talk to me about this. It's a big part of my life to try to bring this to other Catholics and almost like evangelize my own church, just because I feel like when I got this piece of the puzzle, it really did take me to a whole new depth of understanding. And Christian nonviolence is not about just that moment when someone might break into your house and try to like rape your grandma or whatever. Like, it's not about this extreme situation. Once you start going into it, you realize it's about your everyday life. Every day we're making choices to love nonviolently, whether it's refraining from saying that thing that you really want to say to that person because you're right and they're wrong and you want to tell them off, or the way you handle, you know, someone who cuts you off in traffic, or it's just a way of, it's a completely different mindset. And that's what Jesus said. He said, metanoia, change your mind. So what are we changing it from? What are we changing it to? And it helps you to do that. So Father McCarthy, his resources are just incredible. And even if you ultimately don't end up agreeing with it, or you can't completely write off the just war theory, it's still going to help you grow in your Catholic spirituality. So I can't recommend.
Yeah. I mean, yes, yeah, it's part of the church tradition and teaching. I guess we all should dig in there. Ellen Finnegan, you can find her again at courses.teachtothetext.com. We talked about Phil Banners, Faith Journeys, Mermaids, the Just War Theory.
Yeah, next time I'm on, we need to have a lot more fun. I feel like this is a very serious talk, but you and I can have more fun, I think, David.
we could definitely go lighter.
Yeah.
But Islands of Heaven, appreciate you tuning in to this show. And again, if you want to see more Ellen, in Who is Elegant, if you like to see more of her over Satan Dynamics Media, let her know how much you loved her and that she should definitely join our team to be here more often.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I need to get back to you on that. Yeah. Conference season is coming up, so I'm a little busy, but we need to connect.
Yeah. Yeah. But if you like to encourage Ellen, definitely drop a comment in the comment box, send her an email, let her know you liked her time here. But until next time, Ellen, thanks for coming on Off Code and Unscripted. And thanks for being completely off code.
Thank you, David. This was awesome. I really appreciate it. And I hope we can talk again soon.
Amen. Thanks be to God.